to have a full crowd today, and so we're going to mute everybody. So if you have any questions during the program, please just email them to me, and I will pose them to Lisa. The email address is questions, with an F on the end, at ahaprocess.com. And you can send that anytime you think of one. And if you think of it, you know, an hour after the call, you can still email me, and I will forward it to Lisa. So good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to the teleseminar on helping the under-resourced learner. We'll hear how working with adults and students from poverty is foundational to closing the gap in achievement and raising the number of students recognized as commended in a large suburban district with an increasing number of LSES students. During the call, again, if you've got any questions, that email address is questions@ahaprocess.com, and I will pose those to Lisa when we get to our Q&A time. I know everybody's time is valuable, or maybe you've got a school closing breathing down your neck, so I'll get right to introducing our speaker today. Lisa Casto is from Allen, Texas, and is Director of Curriculum and Staff Development in Allen ISD. She's been a teacher, assistant principal, and a principal. So, Lisa, thank you so much for joining us today, and we all look forward to hearing what you've got to tell us.
All right. Well, thanks, Stephanie, and good morning or afternoon to everyone, wherever you are. I'm delighted that I can share with you the success that we've seen here in Allen ISD as I come to you from the frozen tundra that is the Dallas-Fort Worth area today. We were talking about the weather earlier, and we've had ice and snow today, so we are completely shut down all across the Metroplex. So I know you are probably experiencing weather, and we could probably talk for an hour about that. But let's talk about supporting under-resourced learners. And as Stephanie said, that's a foundational piece for student success in Allen ISD. Many of you out there are probably very experienced educators, and as I frequently say, we experience a wealth of staff development. So I hope today that I'll be able to affirm what you already know, and I also hope that you'll pick up one new idea or how to tweak one of your practices to help teachers and students in your setting. Let me share the agenda for our hour, and that will help those of you who are big picture people. I'm going to tell you a little bit about Allen ISD, and within that, I will share the evidence of our successes. I'll talk about our data. And I'll also begin to talk about our model, including our district team. Then I have for you our steps for success with under-resourced learning, including, and let me name those to see if one of these links to an interest of yours, know your data and your students, data-driven professional development, know your curriculum and address alignment, know your students and intervene. We'll talk a little bit about RTI and research-based strategies. So again, I hope one of those ideas links to an interest of yours. And let me tell you about Allen. Allen ISD is the third suburb north of Dallas, Texas. For a long time, Allen was a typical small Texas town, but has grown enormously in the last 10 years. We will, in fact, be built out in 2 years, opening our 17th elementary. In the last 10 years, we have built 7 elementaries and 1 middle school. And, you know, while you're working on bricks and mortar kinds of things, while you're building lots of schools, you begin to notice some trends in your data, and you notice that your economically disadvantaged students are not performing as well as others and at the level you'd like to see. So today, in a district with 18,000 students, that includes 16 elementaries, 3 middle schools, an alternative school, a 9th grade center, and 1 very large comprehensive high school with 1,200 students per class, we've seen a growth in about 4% over the last 4 or 5 years in our numbers of economically disadvantaged. So while we remain a fairly non-economically disadvantaged district, and I know that some of you had many more challenges with many more under-resourced learners, you have a sense of urgency that comes about from that large number. In a district with a smaller number of economically disadvantaged and some success with lots of kids, it sometimes takes lots of conversations and lots of components to create that urgency of success for all students. So I can share with you how we've really focused in on that, to the point where our data is now saying several things. Our data is saying that we are what's called an exemplary district in Texas, which means that 90% of all student groups pass or meet standard on all of our state achievement tests. And that means our student groups are white, Hispanic, African American, and economically disadvantaged. We also know that we have closed the gap between economically and non-economic disadvantage. That's one of the data pieces that we look at. How are our under-resourced or economic disadvantaged students performing versus our non-economic disadvantaged students? And I bet you look at that also. That was a real telling piece for us. So let me share with you how we've closed the gap in some of the different content areas. ELA has been an area, the English language arts area, in particular reading and writing, as it would be, is an area where we've been fairly successful with all students. So just to hit some highlights of that, for our Hispanic student group, we've closed the gap from an 8% gap to a 4% gap. We, of course, and I bet just like y'all out there, have greater challenges in the math and science area. So in the math area, we've closed the gap between economically disadvantaged and non-economically disadvantaged for our white students from 9% to 4%. For our Hispanic students from 10% to 3%. And for our African American students from 12% to 8%. Because one of the things you're hearing here is that economically disadvantaged students in Allen, as I imagine it is in your setting, our students from all colors and all ethnicities. So one of our focuses was math, and another huge focus for us, and I have some examples to share with you, was in the area of science. That seems to be a real challenge across Texas. And in science, our gap for Hispanic economically disadvantaged was 17%. Different from non-economically disadvantaged. We've closed that to 10, so almost half that, right? And then for African-American students in science, our gap between economic disadvantage and non-economic disadvantage, that is hard to say, y'all. The gap was 20%. We've closed it to 12. So, again, almost half. So those are some huge successes for us. Science was our area that was keeping us from moving to that exemplary rating. So we are very excited of the success of all our kids in lots of different schools and in 10th grade. That was one of our areas of focus. And I can share with you how we closed those gaps. So that's some data and some information about Allen to help set the context for you. The other piece I will share with you that has helped make us successful is the idea that we have established a very strong district team. We have very shared goals and a shared focus. We're very focused on student success, and our superintendent, Dr. Ken Helvey, very much sets the stage for that. He sets the expectations for that. He, in fact, is a learner himself. He's always sharing with us the books that he's reading. He is a believer in professional learning to support adults who learn so kids can learn. He is a data guy, so those information, those pieces of information that I gave you is actually from his charts that he uses to work with our leadership team, and he communicates that message that all kids will succeed, that we'll do this through professional learning, and that our model for professional learning is collaboration. You can see that message on a video that's on our website at www.allen.edu allenisd.org, and that's our welcome to new teachers, because we communicate that up front with anyone who's interested in working in Allen. As a district team of superintendents, cabinet, myself, curriculum coordinators, and all our campus administrators, we look at district initiatives and the balance of district initiatives, and we look at what are the pieces that are going to support our growth and momentum. So that's probably more than you wanted to know about Allen ISD, so let me tell you about our steps to success. First, let's talk about know your data and know your students. This is a key part, a piece for us. It is essential to our success. You've got to dig into your data. You've got to know how your students are doing at every level. You've got to know, and you probably already know this, but you've got to know your district data. You've got to know your campus data. You've got to know your grade level data or your course data, and you have to know your data at the teacher level. One of the issues for us, and perhaps for you, is that all students count for the district. All students count anyway. We certainly want every student to be successful, but as we've all gotten more data savvy, perhaps sometimes teachers say, or campuses may say, well, we don't have 30 economically disadvantaged students, so that won't count, with quotes around it, for our district, for our campus rating at the state. But all students in our district, in Allen, count for the district. So our economically disadvantaged students are spread out all across the district. We may have a handful of economically disadvantaged students at one campus, and then we have several campuses that have 60% economically disadvantaged. They all count for the district. We love to look at our data in one of the ways that we learned from AHA process. We love to talk about who's advanced, who's already performing at high levels. We want to increase their performance. That's been a move we've made, and you'll see that that has affected what we call our commended rates, where kids are only missing one or two questions on a test because we targeted those students. We have lots of students who are proficient, meaning they're easily passing or meeting standard on the test. We, again, may want to bump them up and see if they can move to commended. We also watch those proficient kids who are barely proficient because one or two questions could move them below meeting standard or passing. We watch those kiddos. Now we have some students that are performing at the basic level. They're almost proficient, but we've got to find that area of need for them. And then we also look at our students who are performing below level. It may be a two-year plan to move them to proficient. We look at our students in that way in terms of campuses, in terms of content areas, in terms of grade levels, in terms of individual teachers. Science that I shared with you earlier knew that they needed to focus on economically disadvantaged because they had looked at their data. They knew where students were across the districts. So some of those students, as I mentioned earlier, that could be more successful were in 10th grade. In Texas, the exam to graduate happens in 11th grade, so something happens with 10th graders in Texas with that state exam, but we knew we needed to focus on 10th graders in terms of science. And then some of our students not performing well were at our Title I campuses. So those two areas were leverage points for us for success for kids and success across the district. So at the central office level, we provided more support in those areas to those Title I campuses, and in looking at 10th grade, those principals at those schools and central office were a strong team in the message of the success we wanted for students, and also met regularly to monitor progress, to talk curriculum. And then really the big team of directors, assistant superintendent type people meet quarterly to, again, revisit on how we're doing in those areas. So that's one example of where we've used the data to really focus in. The science team will tell you, as well as all content areas, that we use the data when we're looking at curriculum, We may rearrange pacing calendars to look at more time on certain concepts or objectives. We also use the data to help us create exemplar lessons that show us the best practice of how to teach something. Our teachers use their data in their daily lesson planning during their team meeting. They look at objectives. They go back and look at the state curriculum to see what the student expectation says. We affectionately call it high five and low five, which are the student expectations we're doing well on, which are the ones we're not doing well on. Those would be our live fives. Our teachers also know that they've got to know their data in terms of their daily instruction. They want to know where their under-resourced learners are sitting in their classroom. And sometimes they may pull those students up toward the front. They may give them a permanent seat up front, or they may just pull a group up. They know that they've got to know who those students are as they're grading homework, as they're looking at progress reports, or as they're looking at report cards. They also know that they want to be assessing throughout a unit of instruction to know who to go back and reteach, who to provide focused tutoring for, who to provide mentoring for. So that was a lot of information that probably affirmed what you know about what you do with your data. Our next piece of learning about and working with under-resourced learners had to do with our professional development. And we call it data-driven professional development. We knew that we needed to define our outcomes for working with economically disadvantaged students. And we knew we needed to be clear about how we could support student success. So we use an acronym that we got from NSDC, or now called Learning Forward, saying, what is our focus? Is it within the acronym of KASAB, K-A-S-A-B, the idea of knowledge? We want to build what educators know about students of poverty. Is it attitude? We want to build what they believe about students of poverty. Skills, what educators do for students and with students of poverty. Aspiration, what we desire for students of poverty. Or B stands for behavior, how we act with students of poverty. So we decided that we had several areas that we wanted to focus on, of course. But first was attitude and aspiration. In any district with growing numbers of students of poverty, and I've worked in several now, you know, the idea that all students can learn, and we want to support all students who can learn. So in Allen, all schools participated in what we would call the day one, the real aha of working with students of poverty. And then we prioritize schools based on need. Schools with the most students of poverty, the most numbers of under-resourced learners participated in day two. Then one of our Title I schools, who's the most at risk, has participated in day three, putting together the pieces. What we also wanted to do to continue the learning was institutionalize the poverty piece for all teachers new to Allen. So again, on our website, you'll see some staff development frameworks that define all staff development content for LNISD teachers, and poverty and working with students of poverty is a foundational piece. We have three components. We certainly have the aha piece, the day one piece of learning about working with students and adults from poverty. We've done a blended learning model with that. We have an online course internally, and then we have training that's completed with some teacher trainers who've been through the certification with AHA. We also looked at the poverty simulation from the Missouri Community Action Agency, and perhaps some of you have experienced that. But essentially, educators spend 15 minutes equals a week in poverty, and they have to pay their rent. They may or may not have a car. They may or may not have a job. They may have to look for a job. And educators say things like, I totally forgot to ask my kids about homework, or I left them alone because I had to go look for a job. I'll never forget when the assistant superintendent was in the bus pass line and the week would run out before she ever got to the front of the line. So she just actually camped out overnight so that she could get her bus pass. Within that training, I mentioned that we have an e-course, an online course, over the content of working with students of poverty. We certainly teach the idea of key points, that these are patterns, and that schools operate from middle-class norms. We also teach the idea of hidden rules. That's huge. You know, in a district with changing demographics, staff sometimes is upset when they see a student who's on free lunch, and the parents may drive a nicer car than that middle-class teacher does. Staff may not understand a student who's a constant jokester because of the aspect of personality in poverty. So those are important pieces for us. We also teach the resources part and assess student resources. We have embedded that in our RTI process. So when student intervention teams meet, it is a regular part of their conversation about individual student success as to what resources the student has or does not have and how we can support them. We certainly focus on the discipline aspect of the framework. We talk about that the students that you know best are the ones that are struggling the most, that you've got to get to know them and build those relationships, because when you understand that whole child, you can certainly find the key to motivating them. We certainly talk with students all the way up through high school, kindergarten through high school, about the idea of choice. One of my favorite high school teachers talks to students about, if what just happened in class happened on your job, what would your boss say? And, you know, the kids always say, well, I'd be fired. So we, again, make that connection for students to see that future story of what could happen to them in real life. So I talked to you about knowing your data. I talked to you about how we've embedded poverty. And now I'm on to the piece about curriculum alignment. This has been a huge piece for our under-resourced students. You know, there are some students today that are going to learn. There are other students that are going to be more challenged, and they need our focus. And that's very true with our under-resourced. So curriculum alignment, a tight alignment of taught, written, and tested curriculum is very important. We've worked very hard to ensure that our teachers understand and know our state standards. We've worked very hard just to make sure that we are double-checking. Teachers certainly know state standards, but we say, just like your bank account, you may not know exactly what the dollars and cents are every day. Well, let's double-check our standards every day. Let's look carefully at the nouns of the content of the state standard, and then let's look carefully at the verb of the state standard, because we want to make sure if students are being asked to analyze that we're not just identifying. We've got to look at those Bloom's levels of the verb in our state standards. We have worked also to align everything within our instructional processes. We certainly, district benchmarks are aligned. We are working and have worked very carefully in math and science that teacher-made tests and quizzes are very much aligned, along with looking carefully at resources. The textbook may say they're aligned to state standards, but let's do that double check. We are also looking now at student work, and so if we know this is the state standard, what kind of assignment are we giving our students? Some folks might say that we're teaching the test. We would say to you, particularly here in Texas, and particularly in all of the four core content areas, that we're teaching the curriculum. In terms of our curriculum, the objectives that are tested on our state test are the ELA curriculum K-12. In terms of math, throughout the K-12 areas, 95% of our state standards are tested on the test. So we're not teaching the test, we are teaching kids our guaranteed viable curriculum here in Texas. So we talked a little bit about that know your curriculum and address the alignment. You've heard about our data-driven professional development, and we talked about know your data and know your students. Well, now let's talk about knowing your students and intervention. When we think about intervention and response to intervention, one of our first concepts that's critical for under-resourced students, we believe, is the concept of first teach. So first teach means how are you going to teach this? How are you going to teach this the first time you introduce the concept? The first time you're going to hit it hard in the concept. We know that how you open a window with students is important as you begin that road to deep understanding. So we've worked with our teachers, as I said earlier, on exemplar lessons so that we're using the best research-based strategy or the best way we know out there to help students understand. And we want to hit it hard the first time around. We also talk about those deep ideas within a content and those beliefs that teachers have about the best way to teach something so you can have some interesting discussions. I am not a math expert, as many of you may be, but it's kind of fun to hear secondary teachers have great debates about the best way to teach quadratic formulas. And certainly if we can agree on those, then we're helping our under-resourced learners because we certainly know that too much information can confuse them, that their minds think differently than perhaps that concrete sequential mind of a student from middle class, that their minds may have trouble sorting and working themselves through the process. So you can have some interesting conversations with that. But if you can reach some agreements on first teach and best research strategies, then we know not every student is going to be successful the first time around. Hopefully you've got fewer numbers who aren't successful. And then it's the idea of systemic intervention. It's also the idea that no longer do we say, well, I taught it, they didn't get it, or I taught it and they didn't do their homework. But it's, did they learn it? What am I going to do differently? So many of our schools at the elementary level are really using their data and have moved to an intervention block during the school day. That's not necessarily required, and we don't believe necessarily that it's absolutely necessary at the elementary level because certainly students can experience intervention during reading at the elementary level by just a second round at the table, a second round of guided reading with the teacher. Or is just a little 10-minute to 15-minute reteach during the math block at the elementary level. Certainly, we know that secondary schools struggle more, or perhaps some of you have come up with some creative ideas to look at an intervention block during the day. And we're working with our secondary teachers to say, particularly at the high school, because we are on a modified block schedule, so they have a 90-minute class period, how do you say to your 25 or 30 10th graders, okay, anyone who's not sure about this, please join me back here. We'll walk through this one more time. That's one of the pieces our science teachers, again, do well. So we really look at how do we provide intervention, how do we provide it in ways that are more than just tutoring. Now, one creative way that the district looked at has to do with tutoring for athletes. Because of the way athletics is scheduled in Texas, many of our students who participate in athletics struggle with finding time for tutoring. And teachers struggle in finding time for tutoring those students. And you know how big football is in Texas and how big athletics are in Texas. Many of our under-resourced learners, our students from poverty, love to participate in athletics. But we also certainly have a rule in Texas called no pass, no play. So if you aren't passing your classes, then you aren't allowed to participate on the team. And your coach isn't very happy about that. So a partnership between the campus's curriculum and athletics evolved, where we have a special time for athletic tutoring. After practice, we have teachers who are willing to stay. Some of them have been paid to do tutoring. Most of them would do it without pay. We actually have a person who coordinates athletic tutoring. He monitors students' grades daily, weekly, progress report time, and report card time. He monitors athletics of students who are athletes, their attendance in tutoring. And if they don't show up when they're supposed to, he tracks their coach down, and he may track that student himself down the next day. So we've got this constant expectations for kids that all kids are going to exceed, and we're holding them accountable. And you would be amazed at the success of our athletes and the pride that they wear, the pride that their coaches wear, and the pride that their teachers feel, and seeing so many of them able to participate, successful on the playing field and successful in the academic field. We also know that we have looked carefully at focused intervention, and even if that's focused tutoring, for our under-resourced learners. It used to be that anyone who didn't do well on our standardized test called TACT all were assigned to go to tutoring, and every student marched through every concept of that test. Well, we've learned, as you have probably learned, that doesn't work as well as it possibly could. So we've begun to really focus. There may be some students who aren't performing in maybe just a couple objectives or a couple concepts. There may be some students who are not performing at all, but we tend to group students into tutoring or intervention by objective so that they're getting the focused learning that they need. It's a real concentration for those students. We may have teachers tutoring at times. We may have peers tutoring at times. We may hire every once in a while if we need to really help some students get over the hump. Another piece that we're experimenting with, and many of you may be far ahead of us, is with the idea of technology. On many of our teacher websites, you would see that they've posted their lesson plan, or they posted the teaching plan for the day of a big idea. Some of our real techie wizards have podcasts out there or a blog going. One of our math teachers asked her students to record how they solved a problem, and she certainly screens it and listens to it, but then it's posted on her website by students. So it's students tutoring each other through technology. I think that's a really cool idea. That's really what we know about 21st century learners, isn't it? So that's a little bit how intervention works in Allen ISD. I refer to exemplar lessons throughout our conversation. So let me tell you a little bit about the research-based strategies. And this was supported with our work with AHA when we began with them back in 07-08. And which of these have been most successful for us? One of the big ideas that sounds like a really small idea that we have really begun to do is involve our students in their learning. So that begins with the objective on the board. The veterans in the room will remember back in the 80s, we were probably all required to put our objective on the board. And somehow, over the years, that disappeared a little bit. But today, we've talked with teachers about the need for students to understand where the learning is going. What am I supposed to learn today? We frequently say the teacher shouldn't be the only person in the room who knows what the learning is today. So you would see across the district that our teachers have the objective, not the topic or the agenda. It may not be the student expectation out of the state standards. That doesn't always make sense to students, especially our primary kids. But somehow they've translated that. So students know what they're supposed to be able to learn and do each day. And it's kind of funny how they've reacted to that. One of my favorite stories is from a Spanish teacher, and one of her students said to her, Mrs. Smith, I didn't learn that today. I didn't learn what's on the board there. And so she said, well, we better go back. We better go back and make sure you've learned that. And he sincerely meant that. So that's been a wonderful outcome that we're seeing. We also know another strategy that we've really worked on is to, an extension of that, is getting the kids to think about what they're learning. And it's the concept of composed questions. The idea that the students can compose the questions related to the content rather than the teacher composing the questions. So if you have enduring understandings in your curriculum documents, okay, students can, throughout a unit or perhaps for review, which is where we see this a lot, students can compose the big ideas, the questions, the things that they think the teachers will ask, the things that not just the teachers are asking, but that would be tested or important for a unit. We see this in science a lot. They've kind of translated it into Jeopardy because kids love Jeopardy and that little bit of element of competition, and seeing Jeopardy happening in a 10th grade chemistry class is a fun thing to see happening. So, students composing questions. Another idea that's been critical for us is the idea of mental models. Mental models really support under-resourced learners. Let me give you a definition that I found about mental models. It comes from Peter Senge. He says that mental models are the images, assumptions, and stories which we carry in our minds of ourselves, other people, institutions, and every aspect of the world. Like a pane of glass framing and subtly distorting our vision, mental models determine what we see. Human beings cannot navigate through the complex environment of our world without cognitive mental maps. So we knew for our under-resourced learners that we had to create cognitive mental maps. We needed those pictures, we need that image, that visual, that analogy, that metaphor, that story. You know, for you, if I gave you the word home, you have a picture instantaneously in your mind of home. And for different people, that looks very different. If you lived in many neighborhoods here in North Texas, it looks like a brick two-story home. If perhaps where you are, that looks like a frame, a white frame farmhouse. You know, that looks very different from place to place. For some students, that would look like an apartment. So we wanted to help them with mental models for their learning. And certainly the AHA folks have lots of mental models out there. One of ours that is district-wide, probably K-8, it fits K-8 the best. It would work well with 9 through 12 math also, but we use what we call UPS check for math. Understand, plan, solve, and check. You'll see posters in our classroom. You'll see students working in groups talking themselves through that. You'll see them on occasion writing that in their math journals. And our math instructional coaches could share with you about 5 different ways that they know UPS check, but that's been an important mental model for us in terms of math achievement for all students. The other idea we've used in terms of mental models is the idea in vocabulary. You know, the idea that the AHA folks teach us about sketching and drawing pictures. Science has adopted the Frère model of teaching vocabulary. That's been critical for our under-resourced learners, as well as, and this probably connects back to the idea of casual and formal language, of in vocabulary discussing academic vocabulary. Students of poverty especially, and students we want to perform at commended levels, whether they're from poverty or not, need to know academic vocabulary. So talking K-12 about the proper names of things, for example, you know, using addition and subtraction with kindergartners instead of plus or minus. Now talking in geometry about rhombus and vertex instead of diamond and corner. And certainly for under-resourced learners, hearing that consistency of vocabulary from grade to grade and teacher to teacher really supports their learning. And I hate to mention it, math people out there, but certainly hearing denominator and numerator instead of bottom and top. We focus on academic vocabulary in every content area. I gave you some math examples. That would be another area for us in terms of science that has supported closing the gap and supported commended rates. Finally, I talked to you a few minutes ago about student ownership. And we began to look at student ownership in terms of composing questions and looking at vocabulary. We also began to talk about goals and future stories with students, like the chemistry teacher who says, what would happen if that happened at your job? So kids know how they're doing, and the intention is not to stress them out or have them worry about how they're performing, but it's to get them thinking about, what am I strong in, where are some areas that I can focus on, and what's my goal? So we conference with students, and we set goals with students. We might even talk about their daily work or review assignments. It'd be the idea of, what did I get right, and I can do that again. You know, I feel comfortable with that. I can do it again. What that I may have gotten it right, but I'm not sure about that. And perhaps you've heard your children at home say that to you. And what really don't I understand? Right, kind of those three categories for our students. And as our students grow older, talking to them about those ideas connected to their future story. What kind of job do you want? What do you picture yourself doing? What kind of car do you want to drive? Where are you going to live? We have some folks at the high school, in addition to counselors, called Career Pathway Advisors, that work with students on their four-year high school plan and their post-secondary plans, but really looking in those areas. So I've walked you through a big agenda, and you may have questions. So what's still swirling in your head?
Okay, well, we had one question here about, the person asked, how will Common Core affect your district?
Oh, that is a great question. Because what we know is that 21 or so states across the country have adopted Common Core, but Texas is not one of those states. Because remember, you all, we are the Lone Star State, all right? So we're staying with our state standards. However, we are in a current state of revision. And so this year we've had new ELA state standards. Next year we'll have new social studies. And next year we have a new state achievement test. So we're feeling like we're in much the same place that many of you all have. We've been in a constant study of those state standards, and as soon as we finish up in April with state testing, we're really going to hit it in gear of getting ready for next year. We've been sending out teachers out to staff development to learn about the new tests coming, but we're waiting and really going to use summer and fall to begin to gear up. So I hope that answers your question.
Terrific. And if not, they can follow up with another question. But in the meantime, I have another question for you, and that is, the person was asking, what are some of the unique learning attributes of low-resource students? The person said, I'm hearing some examples here and there, but I guess they want some a clump of of learning attributes.
Okay, fine. When we talk about under-resourced students, and there are lots of ways to call that, sometimes the federal government may call that at-risk learners, and there are, within the federal government, there are some defined kinds of ideas that allow the students to be coded at-risk, but in Allen, for us, it's many of our students of poverty, meaning they're qualifying for free and reduced lunch. They also may be students who've been retained a grade. We don't have many of those because of what the research says about retention, but certainly we have some parents who like to retain kids. They would be many of our secondary students that have lost credit or in terms of credit recovery, working on that. they may be students who are encountering some discipline issues that are getting in the way of their learning. They may be students who just seem to struggle, perhaps aren't qualifying for special education, kind of your slow learner idea. They may be students of mobility, students who move from place to place, so they end up with gaps in their learning. So I hope that gave you lots of examples of students who could fall within that. And again, I'd recommend you look at those at-risk qualifiers for your state, how students end up with that identifier in your student system.
Okay, let's see. And let me just double check. Okay, I don't have any other questions at this point. I don't know if you've got another couple of tidbits for us.
I just hope you all that you've gotten some ideas that have really helped you. Probably the pieces that I would say to you have made the biggest difference in Allen, if I haven't said this before, is really knowing our students, knowing our data about kids, but also knowing the students themselves. And we look at lots of data. I may not have said that clearly enough, but we want to know our discipline data. We want to know their attendance rate. We want to hear what teachers say about how students perform in the classroom. Any student that we feel isn't building relationships with their peers, how can we help them with that? Because we don't want kids to be isolated. And that's where our RTI process, our student intervention teams, really look at kids. We'd say to you that's real important. The curriculum piece and the alignment of curriculum and best practice instruction is the other big piece that has really helped us. Knowing our content and teaching our content well really helps our under-resourced learners. And then we'd say to you the intervention piece, making sure the kids aren't falling through the cracks, that we're intervening for them early, that we're intervening quickly in what they need, that we're responding to their needs. That's probably the three biggest ideas I would attribute to our success in Allen.
Wonderful. Well, thank you so much. And I'd just like to say to the audience that if you think of something in a little bit and think, oh, I wish I had asked that, go ahead and forward us that question, and I'll forward that on to Lisa so that you can have the information you need. I want to thank Lisa so much for joining us today, and hopefully you stay safe and don't have any ice incidents. hopefully you don't lose power. I know we lost power here last week in our ice storm, and so hopefully that doesn't happen for you. But thank you, everyone, for joining us. Thank you so much, Lisa, for sharing all this wonderful information, and we'll see everybody, hopefully, or we'll hear everybody, hopefully, next month on our next teleseminar. Thank you so much. Bye-bye.
Bye, everybody.